place. Rhys made up his mind that if things went bad, he would not involve Liz any further. She'd done more than enough by now and had long since repaid her debt. He had a hunch that, at this point in the game, she was helping out of her own anger over the murder of her friend Lauren and her adopted niece, Lucy. Getting one of the few true friends he had left in the world arrested or killed wasn't part of Rhys's plan. It's now or never. Rhys took a deep breath and tightened his grip on the handgun inside his backpack. As he made his way quickly down the stairs, he heard the sliding doors open on the van. Liz obviously had eyes on the steps in her rearview mirror and had pressed the button to open the automatic doors. He saw the van's brake lights come on, indicating that Liz had put the vehicle into gear and was ready to go. He scanned the parking lot as inconspicuously as possible as he walked down the sidewalk that ran parallel to the van. His knees still throbbed a bit from his PLF onto the platform, but he was confident that the injury was relatively minor and he could run if he had to. As his forward progress brought him alongside the van, he reached in and grabbed the inside handle, slinging himself into the back seat. The van lurched forward as soon as his feet left the sidewalk, and Liz sped toward the station exit. Rhys drew the Glock from inside the pack as the sliding doors began to close, alert for anything out of the ordinary. Liz turned underneath the rail line and onto West 20th Street, making a quick turn left and then gunning the engine to merge onto the Hialeah Expressway. If the feds were going to make a traffic stop, they would have done it before now. She glanced up into the rearview mirror through her aviation glasses.
You okay, Bubba?
Rhys breathed a sigh of relief. Better now. Thanks for the pickup. How'd you get wheels?
FBOs almost always have cars or vans that you can borrow. They make so much money selling you fuel that they'll do anything to make you happy. Did you wreck your friend's truck already?
I did. I'll tell you about it in the air. People here drive like shit.
You've destroyed two perfectly good vehicles in like 24 hours. People are going to stop lending you stuff.
As they drove eastward paralleling the Metro Rail tracks, it became obvious that they were retracing Rhys's path from just minutes earlier.
Don't say a word, Rhys. I've never been to this city in my life.
I didn't say a thing, Liz. Just do your thing. They turned left at East 8th Avenue and the neighborhood became even more residential. It occurred to Rhys that if he had to bail out of the vehicle, this maze of houses, fences, and small backyards would make pursuit difficult unless the cops brought in a helo. He took note when they crossed a small canal, undoubtedly made when the land was drained to make it a hospitable suburbia. As they neared the airport, the scene became increasingly industrial. Their path took them through warehouses with loading docks, building supply companies, and auto repair shops. Rhys was pretty sure he'd seen a gunfight scene in an old episode of Miami Vice that was filmed in this area.
Anything hit the news about me yet? Rhys asked.
Not yet. I figured it would have by now. They're still saying the attack on the Admiral was either terrorism or workplace violence, depending on which news channel you watch.
They know. All they need to do is talk to Tedesco's wife and the pieces will fall into place. They're probably figuring out their plan before hitting the news outlets.
Rhys could hear a private jet on final approach above them as Liz drove north through an intersection. The light turned yellow as she crossed the parallel street, and she hit the accelerator so as not to run a red light. As if in slow motion, the light turned red above them as a green and white Miami-Dade police Dodge Charger sat at the traffic light to their right. The police car turned right and sped up behind them.
Chapter 61.
Oh, shit, Rhys, so sorry.
The Charger maintained its pace just a few feet behind the minivan for an agonizing 10 seconds.
Maybe he won't pull us over, she said hopefully.
Just then, the red and blue light bar illuminated and the siren let loose a short blast that made Liz jump in her seat. She checked her mirror as she engaged her turn signal and pulled over to the curb.
Don't say a word, Rhys, and please don't shoot him,
Liz said, remembering her grandfather.
Check.
Rhys faced forward and slipped the Glock under his right thigh, putting both hands on his knees where they would be easily seen.
Liz put the vehicle in park and removed the University of Alabama ball cap from her head. She quickly pulled the elastic band from her ponytail and flipped her head side to side to let her hair down. With her right hand, she tugged at her tank top to expose as much cleavage as she could and put on her most seductive smile. The officer who appeared at the window was young, fit, and Latin, with a uniform that was meticulously pressed. Liz thought he looked like a guy you'd see in a Spanish-language soap opera, which made her own acting performance that much easier. She pulled off her Ray-Bans to give him a look into her blue eyes. Her ample southern accent became even more pronounced as she addressed the officer while sounding like a character from Gone with the Wind.
"I am so sorry, officer. That light changed and I didn't know what to do."
Despite the gravity of the situation, Reese nearly burst out laughing. "Can I see your license, registration, and proof of insurance, please, ma'am?"
"Yes, sir. Of course."
She retrieved her license from a small zippered bag on the passenger seat and opened the glove box to look for the rest of the documents. When Reese noticed the officer's eyes shift to check out Liz's fit body instead of watching her hands for a weapon, he was pretty sure that her acting job was paying off.
"This is a loaner van from the airport's FBO, so I hope it has everything in here."
She was relieved to see a short stack of paperwork when she opened the compartment and grabbed the entire pile. She thumbed through the documents on her lap and quickly found a Florida vehicle registration sheet and a small insurance card. She placed her license on top and handed the stack to the stone-faced officer.
"I'm so sorry. I'm a pilot and had to pick up my client in Miami Lakes. I don't know this area and was trying to do too many things at once."
The officer glanced at Reese in the back seat and held his stare for several seconds, clearly sizing him up. Despite his disheveled appearance, Reese put on the most pleasant face possible.
"I'll be right back, ma'am."
The officer retreated to his patrol car, where Reese assumed he was running both Liz and the van in his computer database. They were about to find out very quickly whether he was the subject of a nationwide manhunt, and if anyone in the law enforcement community had tied him to Liz Riley.
"I don't want to shoot this poor bastard, but hope is never a good plan. If there is even a hint he is onto us, I need to disable him, his vehicle, and his radio and drive east to find a marina, steal a boat and head offshore. Think with your dick, officer."
Reese shifted his eyes between the watch on his wrist and the rearview mirror, counting the minutes and looking for any sign that the officer was making a radio call. 4 minutes passed before the door opened on the police car. Reese studied the officer's body language as he approached. His right hand held a metal ticket book, not his sidearm, and his left hand hung calmly at his side. His stride showed swagger rather than fear. Any sane human approaching someone who they thought was an armed and dangerous domestic terrorist suspect would approach with more caution or stay in their car and call in SWAT. The officer rested the metal ticket book on the van's windowsill where Liz could read it.
"Ma'am, I've written you a warning for failure to obey a traffic control device, which would have cost you $204 and 3 points on your license. If you're a pilot, you should be more careful than that. Please sign the warning on the bottom line."
Liz leaned forward to sign the warning and made sure to allow the officer as much of a view down her tank top as possible. It worked, as he paid no attention to Reese whatsoever.
"That is very understanding of you, officer. Thank you so much for not giving me a ticket."
"Yes, ma'am. Please have a good day and try to be more careful. This copy is yours. If I pull you over again, I'm going to have to write you a ticket."
"Yes, sir. I promise that won't happen."
The officer finally broke into a smile and nodded to Liz. "Please have a safe flight, Miss Riley."
"Oh, I will. Thank you so much, sir."
The officer was nearly blushing as he turned to walk back to his car. When he got to the rear of the minivan, he came to a dead stop, paused, and turned back toward the window. Reese subconsciously flexed his right hand and took a deep breath to fight his racing heart rate. The officer stooped downward so that he had a direct view at Reese.
"Sir, why don't you have any luggage?"
Reese did his best to force a smile.
I just flew down here to look at some real estate. I didn't stay overnight, so what little I brought is in the plane. The officer stared at Reese for a moment, looked back at Liz, and nodded his head. Safe travels. Holy fuck, that was close. Liz started the van and put it into gear, pulling onto the road before the officer had even returned to his charger. Reese felt the surge of euphoria that always followed a life-or-death encounter. His head began to swim with endorphins the way it usually did after a successful mission or firefight overseas.
Reese, do you mind if your pilot for this evening flies intoxicated?
Reese exhaled a giant lung full of air. I'll tell you what, I have never been so glad to have a hot female gym rat for a pilot. Liz looked back at Reese in the mirror and flashed an embarrassed grin. She immediately pulled her top up and reached over to put her hat on. 10 minutes later, she was all business as she meticulously went through the pre-flight checklist. Neither Reese nor Liz's blood pressures began to return to normal until they were wheels up over northern Dade County. Chapter 62. The Pentagon, Arlington County, Virginia. Generals Lewandowski and Stewart waited in the secure conference room. They were given specific instructions not to include any deputies or aides in the meeting, which was highly unusual, if not unprecedented. Lewandowski was nearing the end of his tenure as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He had been a stud fighter pilot, one of the few fortunate enough to see air-to-air combat during Operation Desert Storm. He also played the political game well enough to have risen to the pinnacle of the military food chain. Mentally, he already had one foot out the door as he looked forward to sitting on a few corporate boards in retirement. He had a laid-back demeanor that made him well-liked among both his fellow generals and the men serving below him. Ewell Stewart was very much the opposite, intense, opinionated, and decisive. A native of rural Virginia and direct descendant of Civil War General Jeb Stuart, General Stuart was probably liked by no one, but respected by all. He'd spent his early career as an infantry officer in the Ranger Battalions before being selected for the Army's Special at Fort Bragg. He was currently in charge of the Joint Special Operations Command. Neither man liked or respected Secretary Hartley, though both understood and valued the U.S. tradition of civilian control of the military. Hartley was a pure politician, checking the SecDef box to build her credentials for a White House run. It wasn't just that she was a phony who didn't take the job seriously. It was her blatant practice of funneling every dollar she could muster through her husband's consulting firm that they found so offensive. If you wanted to sell a fighter jet, aircraft carrier, or armored vehicle to the military, you'd better hire J.D. Hartley. Want the contract to run the mess hall at Bagram? Retain J.D. Hartley. The Hartleys treated the Pentagon like the world's largest ATM. Like many politicians, Lorraine Hartley had started out with good intentions. As a college student, with the help of a few of the more radical faculty members, she became outraged at what she came to see as injustices imposed by the U.S. government on countries around the globe. When she met J.D., she found a partner who would help her change the world. After J.D.'s election to Congress, their lives transformed dramatically. Everywhere she went, she was told how great she was, how smart she was, how talented she was. Before long, she was believing every word of it. The entitled behavior of both Congressman and Mrs. Hartley became increasingly outrageous, but in D.C. there were always suit-clad enablers willing to keep things quiet. By the time she was appointed Secretary of Defense, Madam Hartley had become the epitome of what her 20-year-old self had sought to stand up against. Both men had busy calendars, and it was 15 minutes after the scheduled meeting time when the SecDef finally arrived with her deputy secretary and young female aide carrying an iPad. The message was clear. You can't bring your staff, but I can bring mine. You weren't supposed to bring electronic devices into a secure room such as this, but neither man was willing to fall on a sword over that point. She greeted both men with a plastic smile before taking her seat at the head of the conference table. She was wearing a classic black suit made by St. John Knits, her usual attire.
a propensity for wearing all black concocted after a focus group determined she was most trusted in that color, combined with her sour demeanor, was the reason for her nickname among the military officers who worked around her. The Undertaker. Though no one ever dared use the moniker in front of her, her network of civilian rats let her know that she was so named. The fact that she was viewed as intimidating and insensitive pleased her. The Joint Chiefs don't have direct command authority over military units. That structure flows directly from the SecDef to the combatant commands. Though previous SecDefs relied upon the Joint Chiefs for their advice and expertise, Hartley rarely did. Secretary Hartley acted as if Lewandowski weren't even in the room, as she directed her comments only to General Stewart.
"I've just come from a meeting with the Secretary of Homeland Security. The blast that killed Admiral Pilsner came from a suicide vest. The man wearing the vest was a financier with no terror connections, and he did so because his family was being held hostage."
She left out the fact that she'd known Mike Tedesco for well over 10 years.
"The man who strapped the vest on him was a SEAL officer. The one who led that shit show in Afghanistan that got everyone killed. We have reliable information that he's hiding out in some shack in New Hampshire. My people can provide you with the details. General Stewart, I want your SEALs up there as soon as humanly possible. One of our contract security firms will send a team to accompany them."
"I'm sorry, ma'am, but as I'm sure you're aware, the Posse Comitatus Act prevents us from using military forces in such a role on U.S. soil. This is an FBI mission," Stewart responded.
"I didn't ask you for a legal opinion, General. I went to Harvard Law School and don't want or need you to tell me what I can and can't do. I'm telling you to get your SEALs on a plane and get their asses to New Hampshire."
"I cannot give that order, ma'am. It violates the Constitution."
"Fuck the Constitution!"
The SecDef's aide, who hadn't said a word thus far, glanced up from her iPad and interrupted.
"Actually, Madam Secretary, it's not in the Constitution. Posse Comitatus is part of the U.S. Code. It's federal law. It didn't even apply to the Navy until 1992.
The SecDef looked annoyed at her aide for the correction, but directed her anger back at General Stewart.
"What are you, a fucking Eagle Scout? You give that order, or not only will I demand your resignation and get it, but I will make sure that your beloved command is defunded into obscurity and that your men are reassigned to conventional units. You will be responsible for the death of special operations."
Stewart sat back, stunned.
"What's it going to be, Stewart? Are you going to give the order, or do I have to keep firing generals until I find one that will do his job?"
Chapter 63. Senior Chief Fred Strain had sent the recall text out to the Iridium satellite pagers of the operators in his assault team less than an hour ago. There was no excuse for missing that recall, and now each member of his 8-man team was assembled in the conference space attached to their squadron room.
"All right, guys, this is a friggin' crazy one."
Fred was trying to stop swearing so much. He gave it up along with drinking after his wife gave him an ultimatum: stop drinking or leave the teams. Fred had stopped drinking. He almost shook his head as he chose his next words carefully.
"We are going after one of our own. Are you all aware of what happened at Warcom?"
Heads nodded up and down. It had been hard to miss. The media loved the SEALs these days. Even before the Bin Laden mission catapulted them to cult hero status, there had been movies, books, video games, and other high-profile missions that had brought them into the spotlight.
"You're not going to believe this, but the evidence is pointing to a SEAL as a perpetrator."
Looks of disbelief were shared among the group. Nobody liked Warcom, and everyone had an intense dislike for the current admiral, but to blow him up? That seemed a bit out there. The current working theory in the media was that it was an Islamic terrorist group seeking retribution. "Who's the guy, Senior?" one of the younger SEALs asked. Fred paused. He almost couldn't bring himself to say it.
"Lieutenant Commander James Reese."
"No fucking way!" the younger SEAL shouted, shaking his head. "No fucking way!
He was my platoon commander before I came here. Total stud. Prior enlisted, he gets it. No way that guy did this.
Enlisted SEALs' contempt for officers was well documented. Every now and again, there would be one who broke the mold, who was admired for his leadership, battlefield prowess, aggressiveness, and character. James Reese was one such man.
Sorry, Smitty. It looks like it's true.
Well, if he did this, he had one damn good reason.
Doesn't matter the reason, Smitty. He did it. Plain and simple. I knew him as well. We were paired up in sniper school and operated together back in the early days. As solid as they come.